The world is becoming more complex every day. Technology solves problems and creates new ones. How do you keep up? Hi, I'm Rob West. Among so many other things today, maybe you've noticed that managing your finances is increasingly complicated and involves more than balancing a checkbook. Sharon Epps joins us today with some much-needed advice, the five D's of a financial reset. Then we have lots of great listener questions ahead, but we won't be taking your live calls today because this program is pre-recorded. This is Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Biblical wisdom for your financial decisions. Well, I always love when Sharon Epps stops by. She's president of Kingdom Advisors, and let me explain what that means. Part of her job is to advise the Christian financial advisors who give you advice. Sharon, great to have you back.
Glad to be back.
I think we can all agree that managing our finances can be a challenge sometimes. Financial problems seem overwhelming, and so I'm looking forward to you sharing some thoughts on what we can do about it.
Well, whether we're struggling with our finances, they're stable, or we even have a surplus, sometimes we just need a financial reset.
Yes.
Just like our computers need resetting occasionally to clear the cache and run more optimally, our finances can drift or creep out of order. The reset recenters our minds and helps us focus on the spiritual priorities, and they're really the key to getting back on track. In fact, Romans 8:5 tells us exactly what our spiritual priorities should be. It reads, "For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit." So we want to live according to the Spirit rather than the flesh, and to do so, we need a mindset of surrender to God's ways, including how we handle our money.
That is so well said, Sharon. So let's unpack these five D's of financial reset. Where do we start?
The first D is define. What does that mean? You should write out a standard of living statement. Define how you should live. What's your why? Your motivation must be deeper than just financial health. That's too vague. What about the motivation of life and peace? In fact, John 10:10 says, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." And then 1 Timothy 6:17 through 19 reads, "As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They're to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life."
It's a powerful verse, and that is a great foundation. All right, the second D of our financial reset.
Let's try declutter. Not just your desk area, but the whole house. Spend a weekend going room to room asking, "Have I used this in the last year? Is it still helpful to me? If not, sell it, or better, give it away." Decluttering your house goes a long way to decluttering your life. Now, third is delay. Make what you might call an impulse list. Things that you want to buy, put the day's date on them and commit to waiting 30 days before buying an item. You'll probably discover you didn't really need or want the item after all.
I love it. Declutter is my love language, not necessarily delay, as you might imagine. So, all right. I see the next D of our financial reset also involves 30 days. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's detect. Create a 30-day record of your spending and review your expenses. Now, that's one thing that's gotten easier with technology since we rarely spend cash. Just take a look at your bank and your credit card statements, all probably online. What would you change? And I have to give a shout out here for the FaithFi app. It combines all of our accounts in one place, so Joel and I can use a single source to stay on the same page about our money.
I couldn't agree more. Julie and I use it the same way. All right, what is the last D in our financial reset, Sharon?
Well, that would be decide. This is where you draw up or overhaul your spending and giving plans. Revamping your budget is a powerful reset experience. Check your priorities and decide where your money will go. And be sure you make giving an important part of your plan as well. Where can you make adjustments so that you can be generous with your church or other ministries that you're passionate about?
Oh, this is so good, Sharon. You know, we all need a financial reset from time to time, and you've given us some practical steps to do that. By the way, folks, she mentioned the FaithFi app. It has a powerful feature where with one click of a button, you can reset the system and start over if you haven't been in a few months. Sharon, thanks for stopping by.
Always glad to be here.
As I said, we're off today, so don't call in, but we've got some great calls lined up in advance, so we'll go to those just around the corner. I'm Rob West, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to a best of broadcast of Faith and Finance with Rob West, and it's one of our most popular broadcasts that aired this past year. Hey, if you hear the phone number mentioned today, please ignore that number and don't call us because today's broadcast was previously recorded. But we think the upcoming information will help you and make you a wise steward of what God has given you. So please stay tuned.
Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance here on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. All right, it's time to take your calls and questions here on a Friday. I'm sure there's some things you're wrestling with as we head quickly toward the weekend. We'd love to help you tackle those in light of biblical wisdom, help you make a decision to move forward with confidence. In the backdrop of all of these issues and questions we'll discuss today is a biblical worldview of money, that it's a good creation from God. It's a blessing. The key is we can't worship the creation over the creator. When we do, well, things go awry. The Bible is clear. You cannot serve God and money. But when God is our ultimate treasure, when we're rich toward God, as we see in Luke 12 in the parable of the rich fool, treasuring God above all else, and then putting money in its proper place as a tool to accomplish God's purposes, well, it's a powerful force for good because it's the way God intended it. We provide for our families. We give it generously. We can even deploy it as capital to invest in businesses in exchange for a small piece of ownership of that company, businesses that are meeting needs and blessing the world, even promoting human flourishing. That's the opportunity we have with God's money as we're stewards or managers. The question is, what kind of manager are we, and how do we do that together? Well, we want to help you navigate that role you have as a steward of God's money. And so before we head to the phones in the news today, well, several things. One of them is Fed Chairman Powell has given his strongest signal yet that rate cuts are coming soon. Here's a quote: "The time has come for policy to adjust." So essentially, he's saying the Fed intends to act to stave off weakening in the labor market and the economy as a whole. That means it's all but certain, as he speaks from Jackson Hole, where he's gathered with other leaders and economists, that the Fed is going to cut rates. And, well, of course, the market is responding as you might expect. And we'll continue to watch this. Jerry Boyer will, of course, be by today here on a Friday in our final segment to help us make sense of all of it. I suspect I know what Jerry's going to say, but we'll look forward to getting his take just around the corner. Let's head out to Texas and welcome John to the broadcast. Go ahead, sir.
Well, hey, Rob, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question pertains to capital gains. My wife and I are both retired, and so we have a piece of property. So we're talking about long-term capital gains. It's a rental property. Okay. We're thinking about settling it. My question is, I've been doing some independent research. There are different interest rate categories, I know. But in terms of what category you fall into, is that based upon your total income or your adjusted gross income? Mm-hmm. Is that figured on your adjusted growth? That's my first question. Is it the total income before tax, before deductions, or is it your adjusted gross income?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's what they call taxable income. So it's your ordinary income plus interest income, dividends, rental and royalty income, capital gains. So both short term and long term. Other gains, taxable Social Security benefits, retirement income, and then certain adjustments and deductions,
such as a contribution to a retirement account, health savings account, student loan interest, can reduce your total taxable income. And then the resulting figure would then determine your long-term capital gains rate. Does that make sense, though?
So in other words, when I file my 1040 SR this year, the bottom line in regards to whether I would pay capital gains if I sold a property would be the adjusted gross income after everything you just said is dealt with.
Yes, that is true, because you would be able to take the deductions against that, but you do need to add in capital gains as a part of that taxable income calculation.
In other words, if I sold my property, say for $100,000 of capital gains, I would add that to
my
gross income to determine which category I fell in.
Yes, exactly right. So, you know, the capital gain, even though it has a preferential tax rate in terms of what you would pay, those capital gains, both short-term and long-term, are a part of that total taxable income calculation to determine what bracket you fall into for long-term capital gains.
Okay, so I think this year the zero bracket is like $94,050. So are you saying that if my total income after deductions and everything else was under 94, I would not pay capital gains?
That is correct. But so long as you understand that whatever that gain is for that property you're selling in that year gets added to those other income sources to determine, you know, which bracket you fall into. So if you, after all of your income minus your deductions, you had a, you know, $50,000 in income, but you had $100,000 in gain on that property sale, you'd have $150,000 in taxable income, which would be used to then determine your long-term capital gain rate.
Okay. Well, that makes it difficult.
Yes, it does.
Yes. It makes it difficult. It makes it difficult to pay zero, doesn't it?
It does, okay. Yeah. I mean, unless you're selling a pretty small piece of property in the case of real estate. So it does. Now, you are getting preferential treatment, at least under the current tax law with the capital gains, because you're not having to pay income taxes on it. You're paying the preferential capital gains tax for long-term rates. So you're dropping that down to, let's say, 15%. But yes, to get into that zero strata, it is going to be challenging.
Okay, one last thing real quick. If we went ahead and sold and we had some capital gain, we're thinking about reinvesting that. Would you have suggestions in our situation? We reinvested it to hope to grow it where we might fall back if we needed it for monthly income.
Yeah. You know, I think it always has to do with, you know, your risk tolerance and your time horizon. So what I'm hearing is you said may use it for income, but I'm also hearing you could probably kind of look at this as long-term money in the sense that, you know, even in your 70s, and we haven't talked about your age, but I mean, I would say you should have a 20-year time horizon on the money. And so if that's the case and you're willing to take some risk, I mean, I would say, you know, let me ask, what is your age?
76.
Okay. So I'd probably be thinking about a 70-30 portfolio, 70% fixed income, maybe 30% stocks. You could, you know, put 5 to 10% in precious metals if you wanted to, you know, as a part of that, maybe take off of each side of that. But I think that would make some sense. And then you'd have a growth component with the stocks. You'd have some nice income from the bonds. And those could be government, corporate. And then as these interest rates come down, those bond underlying prices of the bonds would appreciate. So you'd have some capital appreciation in there as well. And perhaps you could get an advisor to oversee that for you. That'd probably be my first choice. If you wanted no risk, you could look at an insurance product like an annuity. Hope that helps, John. Thanks for your call, sir. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Faith and Finance with Rob West. Please remember that our program today is pre-recorded, so our phone lines are not open. We're going to pause now for a brief break, and then we'll be back with more Faith and Finance.
Thanks for joining us today on Faith and Finance here on American Family Radio. In the news today, the cost of attending some colleges is now nearing six figures a year, including tuition, fees, room and board, books, transportation, and other expenses. That's according to the Princeton Review's listing of the best schools in America. Those nearing $100,000 a year include New York University, Tufts, Brown, Yale, and Washington University in St. Louis. All of those schools now have an annual sticker price of more than $90,000 for the coming academic year. Analysts are saying that with a typical increase of 4% a year, and in many years it's running higher than that on college tuition inflation, those schools and others will cross the $100,000 a year mark by 2026. At some point, you have to question whether a diploma from one of those schools is really worth $400,000. Of course, it's important to borrow as little as possible when you head off to college. We're very clear on that. But you can do that by choosing a more affordable school, picking up some AP credits in high school. My son entered college with 15 of them, and he started halfway through his sophomore year on paper, and that really helps. Also, landing scholarships can be a big help there as well. I think the key is making sure that the career track that God has you on, anytime you are borrowing, is going to result in a job on the other side of it with an income that allows you to pay that back in a realistic time frame. I would say use a 10-year payback as kind of your baseline for that. So be sure when you're choosing that major, it gives you the skills employers are willing to pay for, because that will make it a whole lot easier to pay that back. Also, don't miss the opportunity to do some work, maybe working in the summer, at least for the first couple of years before you need to start heading into some internships, maybe getting an on-campus job. I was a resident assistant and had my room and board covered, plus a small stipend when I was in college. I mean, there are ways to get creative that don't take away from your studies and can reduce the overall cost of college. The key, I think, is to be diligent and thoughtful. Don't just accept that even though the government's willing to extend you these loans, don't just accept that that's the way to pay for college. Hope that helps. Let's go to Kentucky. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about our overall portfolio, whether it is conservative enough. My husband's 66, I'm 64. We own our own business, which is kind of winding down. And we have about between $900,000 and $1 million in property between our house and the building that we own for our business and another piece of property. And I was wondering, in the overall portfolio, is property considered aggressive or conservative? Like, how would that work into our mix up?
Yeah. I would say it's on the more conservative end, depending on the property, and assuming it's a residential property, it's certainly more conservative. When you get into commercial, you know, there's just been a little bit more pressure on the commercial market just because of the change post pandemic on how people are working. And so depending on what part of the country it is and the locale, it certainly can be a bit more aggressive. But, you know, given that they tend to have a pretty steady appreciation, real estate does over time, and they're income generating, I would say I'd put it in the more conservative end. The two things that raise the risk, apart from just the changes in the commercial real estate market, are number one, the illiquidity, just meaning that, you know, with stocks and bonds, you can sell them as long as the market's open and get your cash. It's not that way with real estate. It's more time consuming and costly. I would say the other thing is just the lack of diversification is one of the challenges that slightly raises the risk, because typically when we own stocks and bonds, we might own hundreds of companies through an ETF or a mutual fund. Whereas with real estate, you know, you have three holdings. And so if there was something that adversely affected one of these properties, you know, you're just more highly concentrated. So that would be the other risk that you have. But a lot of people have built a lot of wealth in real estate. And I think, you know, the idea that you would continue to let these properties appreciate and then when you're ready to exit this business and or liquidate some of these other properties that perhaps have been income generators, then taking that and deploying that in a fairly conservative, you know, largely bond, but with some stock exposure portfolio that's a little more liquid, can generate some income, get you more properly diversified, I think can be a very effective strategy for you as you head toward retirement. Is that helpful, though?
So it is. We do have, I don't know, probably about 700,000 in stocks. So,
oh, okay.
So how should the stocks be allocated? Like how aggressive, how,
yeah,
you know?
Well, it, you know, there's not a right or wrong there. I mean, it ultimately comes down to what has God entrusted to you? What lifestyle do you feel like he's called you to? How much income do you need? And how much risk do you need to take to achieve your goals? You know, we don't want to take unnecessary risk, especially in this season of life. And it sounds like you've got a good bit in the way of assets. How would you break down the mix of that, what you call the stock portfolio, between stocks and bonds? Is it all stocks or is there some fixed income in there?
There are some bonds. I've just heard you say like 60-40 when you're in your 60s or something like that. And
yeah,
there are
so
some
the
bonds and there are some stocks. I'm not clear on all that. We do have an advisor.
Okay.
I
think this would be a good conversation to have with your advisor. I mean, I will tell you just a rule of thumb, and that's all it is. We used to use the number 100 minus your age, and that would be the amount that you would typically have in stocks and then the rest in bonds. Because people are living longer, a lot of times we'll use 110 minus your age. So, for instance, what is your age right now?
I'm 64, and my husband is 66.
Okay, so let's call it 65. So that would be essentially if we took 110 minus 65, that'd be 45% in stocks, 55% in bonds. Let's say we were to pull 5% from either side for maybe some gold allocation. That'd be a 60-40 portfolio, bonds to stocks. And then as you all age, you would, you know, move more from stocks to bonds. The stocks gives you the growth component. The bonds gives you the income. And overall, it's a more stable portfolio. So it might be good to have that conversation with your advisor to check your current allocation against that rule of thumb. Stay on the line. We'll finish off the air. We'll be right back.
This is an encore presentation of Faith and Finance. You're listening to a best of broadcast of Faith and Finance with Rob West. This program is pre-recorded and one of our most popular broadcasts that aired this past year. We're not available to take your calls today, but you can email us at askrob@faithfi.com.
Delighted to have you with us today on Faith and Finance here on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. We're taking your calls and questions. A lot of questions here. Let's get to as many as we can. Back to the phones we go. Let's go out to Michigan. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am.
I had a question about independent living after you turn a certain age. I'm 58 years old right now. I'm on disability. I only get about $1,300 a month, and that's before Medicare is taken out. And I'm able to work part-time right now out of my home. I guess what I'm wondering is, and I'm married, wondering if something would happen to my husband or if I was left alone, what would be the best option for me? Obviously, I would probably sell my house, and I believe I could wind up with maybe $200,000 or so after taxes and realtor fees and whatnot. But I'm wondering where would be the best place for me to go, what the steps would be, and how I would handle a situation like that.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I'm glad to hear you thinking about that now. You know, we know that the data says that as men, we will predecease our wives, and I think, you know, so often, at least I hear from so many widows on this program that, you know, find themselves after a husband passes away, especially if he's been the one, and this certainly isn't always the case, but if he's been the one who's managed the financial affairs, a lot of times widows will feel, just have a lot of questions and feel, you know, ill-prepared. hard to manage their finances moving forward. And so I think leaning into that right now, Carol, and having a plan to understand not only what assets has the Lord entrusted to you, but kind of what would your next steps be. I think the first thing would be just to establish a reasonable budget to determine kind of what you have available to you. Did you say you're both collecting Social Security right now?
No, neither one of us are. I'm only 58. He's 61.
Oh, okay.
I get disability.
I get disability.
If I ever wound up getting his Social Security, it would be a little bit more than mine. Mine's 1,300. It would probably go up to maybe 2,200, but that's another 9 years away for me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. And is he continuing to work right now?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. And are you all putting money aside every month toward retirement?
It's really hard to do that. I hardly make anything, and he doesn't make a lot, and I have a lot of medical expenses, so it's almost impossible. And then when we do, we need to use it for car repairs and whatnot.
Okay. And so other than the $200,000 you think you could net from the house, what other assets do you have currently?
That's pretty much, that would be it. I don't have any like retirement accounts. I mean, I took my retirement out and I had $30,000 in gold and silver. So I guess that would be another asset.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Well, here's the reality is, the key would be for you all to wait as long as you can to take Social Security, and I think the key for him is the longer he can work, the better. And the same, I know you're on disability, but I think the extent to which you all can delay collecting Social Security, even if he could wait all the way to age 70, that would be ideal because he could get his check up 25% or thereabouts higher than what he's scheduled to get as at full retirement age, which would help because if he's, scheduled to get $2,200 a month at full retirement age, that would, might take that up to $2,750, which could be a pretty significant game changer for you just to have what you need to cover your bills. And you would get that as survivor's benefits. And then obviously if you sold the home, you'd have the couple hundred thousand dollars and, that could be converted to an income stream as well, which would be, probably you could pull $8,000 a year or about $650 a month. So if you put all those together, that's $650 a month. And then if you were to add $2,700 from his Social Security, if he waited to 70, that gives you $3,300 a month. So that would give you an option. I mean, if you ended up spending those assets down because you needed some sort of care, whether that's in-home care or full nursing care or something in between, then that's where Medicaid would kick in and you could go to a Medicaid approved, independent living or nursing home facility, if you needed care, and they would, cover that once your assets had been spent down. So I think the key for you all is just to delay as long as you can, keep your lifestyle at a minimum, try to save when possible. I realize you have a lot of expenses, including medical expenses, but, getting that Social Security up as high as possible and, staying out of debt or getting out of debt if you have some debt now and then ultimately liquidating that home, would probably give you the ability to at least either stay there and cover your bills from Social Security or loan or sell the house, use that plus Social Security, to live. And if at some point you needed some additional care, you could get that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I was just curious, too, one quick question. You had mentioned reverse mortgages before, I think, on here, and you gave a number, and it was movement.com or something like that.
Yeah, so Movement is an underwriter of this program, and they do specialize in the area of reverse mortgages, and that could be an option as well, where if you wanted to stay there, essentially, you could convert that to an income stream and then stay there for the rest of your life as long as you pay the taxes and the insurance. You'd never have a payment, and that would be another way to boost your income. The website is movement.com/faith, movement.com/faith. Thank you for your call today, Carol. We appreciate you being on the program. Let's go to Texas Orden. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for your call. How can I serve you?
I'm 24, and I was trying to look for a home. I think it would, at least in my mind, I think it would be smarter to probably buy a home rather than live in an apartment. But okay. Right now I'm living at my parents' house, but okay. I was just wondering, like, what would be some good steps to move toward a home rather than an apartment?
Yeah, you know, I think the key is for you to save toward that down payment. And I think, you know, as you look at what might be your starter home, whether that's a condo or a single family home, you know, start to look at what you could support with your budget. And there's really two key numbers you want to focus on. The first is, you know, you want to make sure that whatever mortgage you have, that payment, including taxes and insurance, is no more than 25%, at the most 30% of your take-home pay. And you could use an online mortgage calculator to kind of back into, okay, what mortgage could I afford where the payment, you know, is no more than 25 to 30% of my take-home pay. And then that would tell you how much mortgage you can afford. And then secondly would be to say, okay, now whatever that mortgage is, I can add 20% of that, and that's really what I can afford to buy, but I want to save that 20% as a down payment. So let's say that number is $200,000. So you'd want to, you know, make sure you have $40,000 saved up as your down payment, and then get the $160,000 mortgage. Or maybe you can afford $240,000 and then have a $200,000 mortgage. But I think the key is 20% down and a mortgage payment of no more than 30% as a starting point. What you may find is you got to delay it and wait. Be right back.
This is Faith and Finance with Rob West. And today's broadcast was one of our most popular broadcasts that aired this past year. Our phone lines will not be open today, but as always, you can email your question to askrob@faithfi.com.
Thanks for joining us today on Faith and Finance here on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. Here in our final segment, Jerry Boyer stops by, and it's a great day to do it because, Jerry, well, if you're going to give a speech on economics and the markets, you might as well go to Jackson Hole, and I guess that's where they are this week, huh?
I have given a speech on economics and the market.
Well, there you go.
So, now, one of the first thing you notice about Jackson Hole, I mean, visually, you see the Grand Tetons, and that's beautiful, and you might see some elk. But I think the first thing that I noticed was that there's less oxygen at that altitude. And so you're always a little out of breath, and you wonder, like, wait a minute, do I have a chest cold coming on or something? Yeah. It's like, oh, no, there's just less oxygen up here. Right. And I don't know. That might explain the quality of the decisions that come out of Jackson Hole.
I think you're onto something there, Jerry.
I mean, maybe if they'd get down someplace like nice and low near a forest, right, you know, with a lot of oxygen, maybe they could solve the problems. When you're in Jackson Hole, I like to say stop digging. And what they're doing is, what Powell signaled is, okay, we're going to turn on the money printer again. Yeah. Because there were, he didn't say this, but obviously he's influenced by the fact that they overcounted the job growth this year, right, by over 800,000. I know there's a lot of conspiracy theories around that. I was asked to write an article about the deception. I don't think it's deception. I mean, if it was deception, wouldn't they wait till after the election to release it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty damaging to the incumbent party. I think that what happens is when the economy is slowing down more than people expect, then there'll be distortions in counting jobs. So why are there distortions in counting jobs? What people don't realize is when they say this is the number of jobs created last month, that's not really the number of jobs created last month. That's an estimate. They didn't count the jobs. They didn't go 1, 2, 3, right, you know, 114,000. What they do is they use models and they say, well, given this dynamic and past experience, there were probably 114,000 jobs created, you know, what they said last month. But let's say the economy is slowing down more than they realize. then what will happen is when they actually go out and count the jobs, which they do once a year, they only count them once a year, and what they do is use tax returns, where if you lie, you get arrested, then you get something much closer to the real number. The only other time this happened before was in 2009 during the Great Recession. In other words, the economy was doing worse than they realized, and so just filling in the gaps with past experience caused them to overcount the jobs. So I think that's what happened, which means that the economy is doing less well than they've talked about. And, you know, you and I have been talking over the past year, and I've been a little perplexed because I've been saying, well, the economy is slowing down, and yet, you know, we're putting up these good job numbers.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to make of that. Unemployment rate was rising, and, you know, the business surveys were terrible. And if you look at business activity, it was really contractionary. So there was a business recession, and yet they kept posting these big jobs numbers. Well, guess what? It was wrong. It wasn't 3 million jobs created. It was 2 million jobs created. So I think that when that revealed that the economy is worse than people thought, then, of course, the Fed had to pivot to an even more aggressive promise. We're going to cut rates. And Powell basically said that we are going to cut rates. So there's essentially priced in almost a 100% probability of a rate cut. That means you're turning on the money machine. And, you know, market, that's good for markets in the sense that pumping money into markets makes them go up. It's not good for markets in the sense of sustainability, because if these market prices are not based on a fundamentally strong economy and fundamentally strong business and expanding business, they're just expansion of valuation, just bubble valuation, well, then that's not really stable and it's not sustainable.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Jerry, you made a comment a moment ago that the Fed's going to turn on the money supply. Let's talk about that for a second, because I think a lot of people may not understand this, that when, okay, so let's say September meeting comes, they're going to raise rates a quarter of a point. There's not a big dial in the Fed's office that somebody goes over and grabs it and turns it just slightly to the right. I mean, it's really about injecting capital in by buying investments, right?
Exactly. There isn't some big dial. So what they do is they go to the open market desk where there is buying and selling of bonds from banks that the Fed does. So the Fed is buying bonds or it's selling bonds. So if it's buying bonds, it gets the bond and it puts money in. So that's putting money into the system. If it's selling bonds, well, that's pulling money out of the system. So let's say that the Fed decides that they're going to, quote, cut rates. They don't turn a dial to cut rates. What they do is they say to their trading desk, keep buying, keep pumping money into the system until the rate comes down another 0.5%.
Yeah.
So, and that's why there's a target rate, but there's the actual rate. So basically, it's sort of like, here's an analogy that might help. You think of a pool, you know, like an above ground pool that you have in your yard.
Yeah.
You have a beach ball in there. You don't just go and take the beach ball and move it up or move it down. What you do is if you're pumping money out of the pool, the beach ball goes down. And if you pump money into the pool, the beach ball goes up. And that's the same with valuations. So basically, these are instructions. Pump money into the system until the rate goes down to the target, or pull money out of the system until the rate goes up to the target. And they're doing that on a daily basis. Every day, the banks and the Fed are trading back and forth until that interest rate basically is roughly what the Fed said the target should be. But really, the only thing they do is either pump money into the system or out of the system. And what they're saying now is, well, the economy is slowing down, although Powell said, well, the economy is strong, but the job market isn't strong. And I don't understand that. How can you have a strong economy, but we're not keeping up with job creation? I mean, it means the economy is weak. So he's saying, well, we're gonna follow the Keynesian playbook. We need to get people excited again. It's not that we need to cut taxes or deregulate or reward people for productivity or adopt a biblical view of work, which is highly productive and a strong work ethic. No, that's not the solution. We need to excite people. We need to get their animal spirits going, is what Keynes said, because he just saw us as animals. So we're just going to pump money into the system until everyone feels better. We're going to pump money into the system so the stock market goes up, and then people will feel rich. And if they feel rich because the stock market is up, presumably they'll go out and spend because they think spending is what causes prosperity. But you and I know that it's production that causes prosperity. Spending is the benefit of prosperity, but it's not the cause of it.
Yeah, that's helpful. Jerry, I want to get your insights on one particular aspect of economic policy we've been hearing about in the election. And this is not about choosing one side or the other. And we could focus on any number of policy issues, from the idea of lower taxes to deregulation to tariffs. But I want to talk about this idea that's been front and center from the Harris campaign lately. They've been using the word price gouging, and they're talking about price controls. And I guess the thing that I just don't understand is, you know, how does for 35 years the fact that, you know, price gouging hasn't affected inflation, and why, if we had price gouging that led to 40-year high inflation in the last 3.5 years, did all of a sudden price gouging come into play? And if it didn't, then that's not it at all, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, if the idea is that it's corporate greed, well, what are you saying? 5 years ago, corporations weren't greedy?
Yeah.
Or 10 years ago, or 15 or 20 years? Were corporations not greedy for the 80s and 90s? I mean, remember, we heard so much from the other side, from the people who were pushing the price gouging theory, about the greed of the 80s. But inflation was dropping. So
right.
If we were so greedy in the 80s, why is inflation dropping?
Right.
Because corporations are always trying to maximize profit. Corporations always want to charge as much as they can, and consumers always want to pay as little as they can. So the only thing that isn't it funny that corporations seem to be much more successful at being, quote, greedy when the government is printing a lot of extra money? So, you know, I really think there is gouging going on. But it's not private companies. It's the government.
Mm-hmm.
They are paying for services or paying themselves. They're increasing spending without increasing taxes. That shortfall has to be met by the Fed indirectly. So they create new money, and that new money finds its way into the government budget. So there is gouging. You know, Reagan, when he debated Carter about inflation, Carter said, well, the people are living too well. They're spending too much. And Reagan said, no, the people aren't living too well. The government is living too well. The government is spending too much. This is not our fault. It's not our fault when we go to the grocery store, and it's not our fault when we go to work for companies and are the producer of goods and services. This is entirely the fault of the government, and not just of one party. So let's be bipartisan and political atheist on this. The easy money started under Trump, not under Biden. Now, Biden's policies about energy, I think, made things worse, but this is a bipartisan problem. It just does not make sense to blame price gouging. Plus, corporate profits, the growth rate of corporate profits is going down, not up.
Yeah.
So if they're gouging, why aren't they profitable? Also, wholesale goods prices are up. So, I mean, if you're a business, maybe you're charging more at the store, but you're selling more when you buy wholesale. And commodity prices are up, so the companies that are producing the goods and services also have higher input costs. So where's the gouging occurring?
Right.
Prices are up everywhere. And if prices are up everywhere, that's not private gouging. That's government gouging through debasing the currency.
Well, no doubt about it. And it's definitely not the grocery store chain who's got a 1-2% margin, I would imagine.
Yes. I mean, they you know, if they get away with gouging, they would have done it a long time ago. But they can't, because if you don't, you know, whatever your chain is, you know, we have Giant Eagle here, and people have Wegmans and Piggly Wiggly and everything. Or you can go to Aldi's instead, or you can go to Costco, or you can go to, you know, you can go to Sam's Club, or you can go to Walmart. There's a lot of competition out there.
Yeah.
So if there's really gouging, wouldn't another company say, oh, well, we'll keep prices a little bit lower, and then therefore the other can't get away with gouging? We have a hyper-competitive retail market. You can't get away with gouging. So what this is really is, the government is scapegoating businesses. And if they really are serious about this, if they really do enforce that ridiculous mandate, we know the inevitable result. It is as sure as gravity and the sun rising in the morning and setting at dusk, you will have shortages. If not allow companies to charge the market price, if you force them to charge something where they lose money,
we're going to have to leave it there, Jerry. Grateful for you, my friend. Folks, thanks for being with us. We'll see you next time. God bless you.